Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Sam Mace. She's the Inland Northwest Director for Save Our Wild Salmon, a coalition of conservation organizations, sport and commercial fishing businesses, and clean energy advocates working to restore wild salmon and steelhead to the Columbia and Snake Rivers. She works to build support for restoring the Lower Snake River by removing four outdated dams on the Lower Snake River that are preventing recovery of fisheries in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. She lives in Spokane, Washington. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
So can you talk about the salmon in the Lower Snake and, well, in the Snake River and also in the Columbia? Talk about how they used to be and how they are now.
Yeah, so historically, pre-European settlement, the estimates of the number of wild salmon and steelhead that entered the mouth of the Columbia River and went up into the entire basin average anywhere between 16 and 30 million fish, depending on the year, depending on the estimate. It was a tremendous bounty of fish that headed up into the Columbia and Snake Rivers and their tributaries. And when we look at the Snake River, you know, again, these are estimates, but, you know, it was probably 5 or 6 million fish that went up into the Snake River historically. And those include the steelhead fish, the different runs of salmon, the sockeye salmon that spawned in the lakes, that just went up into thousands of miles of habitat up into the Snake River and its tributaries. And today, for a variety of reasons, we have maybe less than 2% of the wild fish returning. And that's because of development, it's because of overfishing at the turn of the century, and it's also significantly because of the number of dams that we have built up these systems that either completely block salmon up off from their rivers of origin, or severely impede their pathway, both as young, tiny smolts going downstream to the ocean and also the adults trying to get up.
So when we talk about so I live on the coast now, on the coast of California, and I think the salmon here, although they're getting hammered too, the salmon here have it easy because they have to swim upstream a mile, 2 miles.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer to this question. Are the Snake River salmon, are they the longest salmon distance in the world, or are they just really long?
You know, that's a matter of debate, but I would say that the Snake River salmon probably travel the farthest of any salmon species in the world, potentially, and certainly climb the highest. Some of these fish spawn upwards of 6,500 feet in elevation in those mountainous areas and those wilderness and areas in Idaho. So, yeah, they go a long ways. Sockeye salmon that spawn up into the Idaho salmon sockeye that spawn up into the lakes in central Idaho travel 900 miles inland back and forth to make those. So, yeah, they have a long ways to go, and they're built for that journey. That's why they historically were some of the biggest fish. They put on a ton of fat, and they were large salmon in order to make that journey up. And they're very resilient fish, but unfortunately we built these series of large dams up the system on the Lower Columbia, on the Lower Snake, and then farther up the system that make it either impossible for them to get to their historic spawning grounds are very difficult. They evolved to go back and forth in these free flowing rivers, and now especially the baby smolts, those young salmon, are now hitting these hot reservoirs, trying to make it back down to the ocean to complete their life history. And instead of just riding the snow melt down tail first, they actually have to swim through these hot reservoirs that cause stress. It causes them more disease, and they're sort of sitting ducks for a lot of predator fish that gobble them up. So the mortality rate we're seeing on our fisheries right now is to the point where it's inching them to extinction every year.
So I want to talk a lot more about dams in a couple minutes, but I have a couple more sort of semi-random questions. The first one is, when you say there were big fish, how big are we talking?
100 pounds. You know, and I mean, the ones that you hear about a lot, and you see the famed photos of are the ones, the June hogs, you know, that made it up into the Upper Columbia system and were caught and made it up into the Spokane area, which, you know, I know that you're familiar with, Derek, having lived in this part of the world. You know, they were upwards and more than 100 pounds. And, you know, you saw some similar fish also in the Snake River that went way up the system. And, you know, we're losing those genetics of those big fish.
And when the salmon go, I mean, so the life cycle of a salmon is that the baby salmon stay at home. How long do they stay up before they go to the ocean? And then how long do they stay in the ocean? And then they go up and then they die, correct?
Yes. And, you know, it really depends on the you know, the run of salmon and the type of salmon we're talking about. But yeah, they'll hatch out in their natal streams. Some salmon, spring, summer Chinook, spawn up in the tributaries. Some spawn, called fall Chinook, spawn in the big main stems of the rivers, like the main stem of the Snake River and the Columbia. You know, other sockeye go up into lakes. And so all these different fish sort of have their own life history and their own niche that they're sort of filling in the broader system. And so it can depends on the species on the run, whether it's months or it's a year, et cetera, before the young smolts decide to head on downstream to the ocean. When they get to the ocean, again, depending on the run, you know, they can spend 2 to 5 years out in the ocean before returning back. And then they head back up the river system and try to make it back to their home river to lay their eggs and spawn in the same river that they were born in. When we talk about salmon, and then we talk about steelhead. Now, steelhead are a little different. They are an anadromous fish, but they're technically a trout. They're technically a sea-going trout. And they have a life history much like salmon. However, the one difference with steelhead is that they can spawn more than once. Not all of them do, but they can. They are, yeah, pretty resilient fish.
So they go up and they spawn, and then they die on a free-flowing... Oh, I thought you said the steelhead can spawn more than once. So the steelhead would float back
steelhead
down?
Can. No, steelhead can spawn more than once, and then they head back out to the ocean and make the trip again.
You know, I've been working on salmon issues for, God, 30 years now. And it's pretty strange because it never occurred to me until this moment that you have a 100-pound fish who was out in the ocean for, let's say it's 5 years. That's still gaining 20 pounds a year. They grow fast out in the ocean.
They do, and it's, you know, one of those incredible, you know, designs by nature, right, where it is this way to get marine nutrients back up high up into these systems, right? You think of all the nutrients and things that are flowing downstream naturally in free-flowing rivers. And salmon are this mechanism for taking all these nutrients back that have flowed down into the ocean and heading them back up into the system. And you know, their dying carcasses up there then feed all these other species, plants, animals. You know, it's wolves, it's grizzlies, but it's also deer. It's also other baby fish, you know, small trout, tadpoles, et cetera, all benefit from that load of nutrients that gets, you know, gets sent back up the system.
I don't remember the numbers, but I was reading somewhere that that baby salmon, like, I don't know, 40%, 60% of their nutrients come from other dead salmon that they feed on. That they're basically, their parents feed them with their bodies as they're growing. It's a fairly large percentage even feed the baby fish.
Yeah, I don't know the exact percentage. I'd like to see that study, but there's a direct correlation. And I've certainly seen studies looking at the health and survival of trout fisheries in streams where there is a salmon run where you have that nutrient load coming back up. Because it does. It feeds the young fish.
And I'm going to make a number up here, but it's not going to be out of line that trees grow like three
yes.
times faster or some crazy number when there are full runs of salmon.
Absolutely. There's been studies done up in Alaska, like on the Kenai Peninsula, where they have determined that 20% of a tree's growth is directly related to the salmon nutrients, because they can tell, you know, where the nitrogen comes in a tree, whether it has a marine isotope or not. And if it has a marine isotope, you know it came, it came directly or indirectly from salmon. And I can't help thinking about, it's one of the things that's always on my mind when we're looking at the forests in Idaho, Oregon, the deserts of eastern Oregon, for example, these places that are nutrient poor systems naturally. And what have we done to these systems by blocking off this critical nutrient load that used to come up to these systems? You know, what's the long-term impact of that? Because I think it's pretty significant.
So, and you said that 5 to 6 million fish would run up the snake. And if we, 100-pound ones are big, so let's just say 20-pound average to make a number up. If we have 5 million times 20, that's 100 million pounds of nutrients every year that were brought. And, you know, if the populations are, 2% of what they were, then that's obviously a lot fewer nutrients for everyone. So when we talk about salmon, we're not just talking about salmon. We're talking about, as you said, grizzly bears, wolves, trees, deer, everybody.
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's talk about dams now. So let's go through a fish's life and talk about, you mentioned before that they would float downstream tail first, which I find interesting for some reason. So talk about, how long it would take them to go from, a mountain, some stream, somewhere fairly up on the Snake River, how long it would take them to go down before, if we know. And then, so after we talk about that, then please run through the dangers posed by dams at every step. Let's follow a fish's life and talk about how a dam hurts it at every stage.
Sure, yeah. So they used to make it down on the, the spring snow melt in 14 days. Even from central Idaho, it was a quick trip, and they didn't have to expend a lot of energy to do it. Now it can take a matter of months.
Oh, sorry. Are they genetically programmed to switch from freshwater to saltwater fish at a certain age, or at or under certain external conditions?
That's a good question. That's a complicated question. My assumption is that it is kind of both, right? There's a certain time frame, time mechanism in which their bodies start wanting to make that shift from a freshwater fish to a saltwater. But it's also then the conditions. And historically, they'd come on down, but then they could hang out in the estuaries, right? They had the ability to give their systems a chance to acclimate. What we have now happening with the young smolts is you either keep them in the system and let them go downstream and maneuver all these reservoirs. I certainly heard from scientists and others that one of the problems of, mortality can be maybe their bodies start wanting to shift to a saltwater before they're actually fully into a saltwater environment. The other piece that you have happen is, the answer by the federal agencies to get these young smolts around the dams has been barging the fish, sucking up the fish and the young smolts onto these large barges, and sometimes trucks, and sending them down the freeway. But putting them on these barges and then barging them down the river system and dumping them out below Bonneville. And it's a program that has created and maintained a lot of government jobs, but it has not brought the salmon back. And what the scientists talk about, the problems with that system, is something they say we have delayed mortality from those fish. And, you know, they may dump them off the barge and they may all be wriggling, but then we're not getting the returns and those fish are disappearing. And there's a bunch of different theories and ideas on that. One is that it confuses their homing mechanisms in terms of when you put them on a barge and shoot them down there, you know, they're not able as adults to find their way back up. But then there's also some thought that it sends the fish then too quickly down the river, and their bodies are not having the time to kind of adjust and prepare for when they hit the estuary and then the ocean.
So thank you. So I interrupted you. So we have a baby fish, and the first problem is that this baby fish does not have the stream is not as healthy as it would be if there had been 100 million pounds of nutrients dumped into the region. So sure. We have a baby fish in an area that's not as nutrient rich as it should have been, but it survives that, and then it starts the journey. So tell me how dams hurt all the way down.
So yeah, so then you have these young smolts heading downstream, and they have evolved for a free flowing river, and they will get to these impediments. Let's say the Snake River salmon get to their first big dam, which is Lower Granite Dam, downstream from Lewiston, Idaho, Clarkston, Washington, and in eastern Oregon or eastern Washington, and they'll hit this reservoir, and so instead of being able to just float down tail first, they actually have to swim through these reservoirs because the current is real limited behind a dammed river. And so they have to spend a ton of time in this reservoir, and it causes them stress. The temperatures of the water are much higher, and salmon need cold water. You start getting mortality for salmon when you have temperatures going above 68 degrees for sustained times. So they're dealing with this impounded hot water, and then they have another dam to go through, and they have another dam to go through, and they have another dam, and they have to make eight reservoirs to get downstream. And the Snake River reservoirs are particularly lethal because Southeast Washington State is, you know, lower. It's high. It's desert. It's hot and it's desert come spring or summer. And so the reservoirs, the water in the reservoirs really heats up. And then when it's heating up and they're starting to feel stressed, they get more diseases. And they're also sitting ducks for a lot of predator fish that really do well in a reservoir environment. I mean, one is the northern pike minnow that is a natural native fish, but not in the numbers it would be because it really loves warmer water. And so they're gobbling up the salmon. So you just have predator after predator, all these hot temperatures. And so that by the time they make it through the system, you know, you have, you know, maybe 40% survival of the smolt.
I know that I've read about when they actually pass the dam, too, that they can have tremendous mortality from passing over spillways or going through turbines. Is that true?
They can. I would say that's one of the confusing parts, and it's a issue that the federal agencies really try to pull the wool over the public's eye. They've actually done quite a bit to improve survival at the dam itself. They have these collectors that collect the fish and direct them to the right place. You know, they've done all these, these improvements that, yeah, at times we won't argue that, you know, when you look just at the dam, when you have a smolt wriggling on one side of the dam, you can get 97% survival. You know, if you then measure all the salmon that are on the other side of the dam. But what they're ignoring is all the mortality that's happening in between the dams and those hot reservoirs. That is the huge killer for the salmon, the smolts at this point. And there's no fix for that. And there has been this debate over over spilling more water at the dams to aid salmon. And that is a that's a measure that our coalition absolutely supports. If you spill more water at the dams, it creates more river-like conditions, and it's far better for fish on this barge and trucking them down the river. There are some folks, weirdly, I do not understand why, on the environmental cause side, that have been arguing that this is get, you know, this is terrible for the fish. And you do, it's true, you will have more fish, some more smolts get what's called the bends, because you, you know, when you spill water at the dam, you end up with a bunch more nitrogen into the water, and that can kill salmon. But when you look at the survival rates, when you spill versus barging them or just having them go down the river, there's a higher survival when you spill that water.
Okay, so the fish, are there other, okay, so we've got warm water, we've got they have to swim as mm-hmm. opposed to floating. They have to, we got more predators. Are there other problems on the way down? I mean, apart from, of course, pollution and blah, 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 but we're leaving those aside for a minute.
All that other stuff. Well, I think another one that, you know, I don't think we need to delve into deep, you know, dive deeply into right now, but, you know, we've also, in, to make up for all the loss of wild salmon, we have now the federal agencies and state agencies and the tribes too, you know, have really relied on hatchery fish, you know, and are pumping more hatchery fish in the system. And I think, you know, now you have these wild salmon that are being surrounded and having to compete for food and getting diseases at times from all these hatchery fish are now into the system as well. And I think, you know, there's some things being done to manage those issues better, but that's also a factor, for sure. And then, yeah. And then so, there's all the, yeah, anyway.
So let's, okay, before we talk about the problems on the way upriver, and then after that we'll talk about removing the dams and other things, but yeah. Before then, can you spend 3 or 4 minutes talking about what's wrong with hatchery fish? Because I mean, shoot, it's more that's putting more fish in the river, and that's having more nutrients come up. Isn't that good? And I want to contrast that just with a quick bumper sticker, which I don't know if they're still around, but I remember seeing bumper stickers all the time in Spokane that was wild sex for wild salmon.
Yeah.
Anyway, so why do those darn environmentalists hate hatcheries anyway?
Well, and I want to say up front that my coalition does not take a – we do not take a big position on the hatchery issue because of the diverse nature of the coalition we are. We are the commercials and the sport and conservation groups working on the hydro system, which at this point is taking 80%. However, even our – I think even our coalition members that right now rely on hatchery fish for their livelihoods – very much recognize the value and importance of making sure that we maintain those wild runs. That those are the, it's irreplaceable genetics. And, you know, these are fish that you're not having to spend hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever it is, I don't know, on hatcheries, right, to produce. And that it's those, from personally, I really feel it's those genetics, those wild genetics that we have to maintain if we want salmon to survive in a warming world. And the way though hatcheries, you know, and some hatchery, you know, I also will say that the hatcheries are very important to the tribes and we work closely with the tribes. But I think that there is agreement that hatcheries have done a number on some of the wild stocks and particularly poorly run hatcheries, and the ways that hatchery fish can impact wild fish is by mixing genetically. As in a hatchery, some are run better than others, but you often have the same genetics circulating in them. And so they lose resiliency, and then they're out in the system, and they are then sometimes end up escaping and spawning with wild fish. And that has a huge impact.
I wrote a book on zoos maybe 17, 18 years ago. Doing the research on it, one of the things that has always struck me, and I didn't know this before I wrote the book, is that even when you have captive breeding programs, which in some cases I agree with, within only a couple, three generations of captive bred creatures, you can start having some significant problems show up that wouldn't have shown up in the wild. I was amazed at how fast. I would have thought, you know, it takes 50 generations of being raised in captivity before you see a difference, but it's actually really fast.
It happens quickly.
Okay, so let's go. We got the fish out in the ocean, and it swims around and goes wherever salmon go, and then it starts to swim back up. And now, how do the dams hurt on the way up?
Okay, and I will say that for Snake River fish, where they go when they hit the ocean, the salmon, some of them turn south and head down the coast of Oregon and actually end up off the coast of California. The majority of them head north and end up mixing with all the salmon stocks up in Alaska. They go up north before they come back. And then they come back and they come up the Columbia. And as they're going up as adult fish, they're having their own predators. They have commercial fishermen, and they have sport fishing folks, and then they have the sea lions, which has been getting a lot of attention below Bonneville Dam. But then they have to hit these dams, and again, it's not as the mortality on the adults from the dams is not as high as the smolts, because you do lose a percentage of the adults that now on the dams with passage have to maneuver and make their ways up these human-built ladders that kind of mimic a uphill stream so that they can get up the dams. But it's exhausting. It's more energy. And then they also have to maneuver through these same reservoirs to get back up. And they are also affected by the rise in temperature, and in particular the endangered Idaho sockeye. Chinook salmon can take a little more heat than a sockeye salmon can. And so when the temperatures get high, we start losing significant numbers of wild sockeye.
I know that on the Klamath, just south of here, that's a terrible, terrible problem, that they've had just huge mortality from, I don't know what the long name is, but the short name of the disease is ICH, I-C-H.
Yeah.
There have been years when it's been a catastrophe because the water's too hot.
Yeah, and it's getting worse, right? And with climate change, we had a horrible year on the Columbia and Snake in 2015, where we lost 99% of the Idaho sockeye run coming back up the river. 45, a couple dozen fish made it back.
Well, that's horrible.
And it was because of the hot temperatures.
So I'm going to ask a question I was going to ask at the beginning, but then I kept forgetting. And I don't know the answer to this, but I have, as well as salmon, I've fallen in love with lamprey. And
I love lamprey.
And I've seen pictures of lamprey on the lower Columbia and on some of the rivers in Oregon that they were just as numerous as the salmon. They were just... It's like entire rocks covered with lampreys.
Yes.
And so how far up did the lampreys go? Did they make it all the way too?
Yes. I'm so glad you brought the lamprey up, because I meant to mention them earlier. Yes. Lamprey made it all the way up into the Snake River, a very important food fish for the Nez Perce and other tribes.
That's crazy. Because salmon, salmon are built for speed, and they, they're strong fish. Tell people very quickly what a lamprey is and how awkward it would be for them to go hundreds of miles.
Yeah, I don't even know really how they do it. So lamprey are a big eel with a suction mouth, And yeah, nothing like, they do not have the size or the fat on them like a salmon does. And they, just like the salmon, are anadromous, make their way down the river, spend time out in the ocean, and then travel back up. And one of the big problems with the lamprey is that, they built these fish ladders for the salmon and steelhead, but those are not set up for lamprey. The lamprey have a really difficult time trying to make it up those ladders. And so
So
it's the lamprey are in horrible, horrible shape in the Snake River.
I would recommend that people listening to this try to look up a video of, I don't know what the search terms would be, like lamprey climbing waterfall or something. I mean, honestly, it makes me cry how hard they're working. I mean, it's wonderful to see salmon jumping. It's beautiful and just shows how just strong the urge to live is. And then lamprey don't have that. What lamprey have to do is grab onto the rock and then throw themselves up an inch, 2 inches, and then do it again and do that all the way up the rock face. It's one of the most stunning things I've ever seen.
Yeah. I
Okay.
would encourage people to look at that. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
So let's talk about what your coalition wants to have happen with the four lower dams. And we're about 30 minutes and we have about 15 to 18 minutes left. And
Okay.
I want to leave some time also to talk about what the heck do the snakes on the dams on the lower Snake have to do with orcas? I do want to leave some time for that. Do you want to talk about that first? Do you want to talk
Absolutely.
about dams first? I mean, what you want to do with the dams first?
Well, yeah, let's talk a minute about the orca because I don't want that to get short shrift.
Great.
For years we've worked with the orca advocates in the Puget Sound because our orca whales in the Puget Sound, unlike other pods and other communities of orcas around the world that eat sea lions and seals and other critters, our orcas in the Puget Sound and the Salish Sea primarily eat only Chinook salmon. That is their food source. And it's their culture and it's their community and it's what they eat. And we have seen the orcas, have declined for a number of reasons, including the, horrific capturing of them by SeaWorld in the 70s. But since then, we are, particularly in the last 2 decades, we've really seen some steep declines in the numbers of our orca whales due to the fact that there is not enough salmon for them to eat. And so when they don't have enough salmon to eat, of course, in the worst case, they can be starving, which they are now. But it also really elevates all the other stressors that those poor whales have today. When they're more stressed when they don't have enough food. So dealing with boat traffic, dealing with loud noises, dealing with all those other stressors, they're less able to do that. And particularly the most heartbreaking way that a lack of salmon is affecting these orcas is that when an orca mother gives birth to a calf, she needs to feed and breastfeed that orca just like a human mother does. And if she doesn't have enough food in her system, just natural salmon that she's eating, she's having to rely on her fat reserves. And because of all the toxics in the Puget Sound, her fat reserves are full of PCBs and toxins and other awful things. And so she ends up giving this chemical load to her calf that they've also connected with a lot of the calf deaths that they're seeing. And so what we've seen in the last few years is a whole number of whales die. We're down to 74 whales, which is the lowest number of orca whales that we've had since the 70s when SeaWorld came and captured a bunch of them. And we're not seeing them being able to reproduce and survive and bring their calves to fruition. And so many of us around the world watched Talaqua, I always say her name wrong, but the mother orca who carried her dead calf on her nose for 17 days trying to send us a message that we need to start doing something for these whales. And so the Columbia Snake River salmon, even though it seems like, oh, that's far away from Puget Sound, those orcas every spring come down. They swim down from Puget Sound and come to the mouth of the Columbia to feed. And they come down and feed at a time that's pretty critical for them because they haven't had a lot of salmon available to them during the winter months, not like they do in spring and summer. And so it's absolutely important time for them to be getting a big amount of salmon to eat and sustain themselves, and they're not getting them now. So we have been partnering with and working even more closely with the orca advocates and the whale scientists to push for removal of the Lower Snake River dams to get a big dose of salmon back into the system and back into these whales' diets, because they're at the level of extinction. If we don't do something, that's very bold and drastic for those whales, we're going to lose them.
So I want to, we talked about the number of salmon that would run up the Columbia, and I mean, numbers are nice and interesting, but what made me think of this is you have the orcas coming down, and I'm trying to think what it would have been like, how easy it would have been for the orcas 300 years ago. And so I've seen some pictures, like a guy sent me a picture from Alaska. They sent me the picture 15 years ago, and they didn't send any note with it. And at first I'm looking at it and it's like, why'd they send me a picture of a river with a river with a brown bottom. It doesn't make any sense. And then I look more closely and I see that at the edge of the river, it's actually yellow. And then I look more closely and I see the reason it's yellow at the edge is because that's sand. And then the reason it's sort of brownish grayish in the middle is because the entire river is filled with salmon.
Yeah.
And I remember reading about, there was a run of salmon up the Fraser River back in 1933 or something, that it basically the salmon had to form a queue outside the river, and it was a plume.
Wow.
That was, I don't know, I'm making up the numbers, but it was like 12 miles wide and 32 miles long or something. It was just, I mean, this is what you have. That's what 100 million fish looks like, or however many fish, 60 million fish, however many fish it was. And so I'm just sort of picturing the orcas coming down and swimming into this sort of river of fish, and they can just snap, 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 and they've got lunch. And, when there are fewer fish, then they have to, not only are there fewer fish for them to eat, but they also have to work a lot harder to get them. I just, the pictures I've seen of the salmon runs, it's like when people talk about the passenger pigeons darkening the sky for days at a time in the eastern United States. It's just the pictures I've seen and the accounts I've seen. The Klamath River just south of here in the 1930s, the Klamath is pretty big. It's the second biggest river on the west coast of the United States after the Columbia. And the entire river was described as, quote, black and roiling with fish. And, I don't think we have any clue.
Yeah.
You can say anything you want about that, or we'll go on to dams, whatever you want.
No, it's true. And the orcas, they're just, I'm not lucky enough to live near the orcas and know them as personalities and as individuals, like some of the people that I work with on this issue. But they tell me how much the orcas used to play and just have fun out there, and now they're subdued, right? You have these creatures that are now having to spend most of their energy and their waking hours looking for food. And it's an incredible stressor.
So we have about 7 minutes left. And so let's transition now to what is Save Our Wild Salmon's position on how much your organization loves the dams on this Lower Snake?
We do not love those dams. And we've been working since the 90s to get them out. And it's been a tough uphill battle. It's a lot easier, although it's hard work often, to stop things, stop a timber sale, stop a pipeline, stop an LNG terminal, right? Those are hard, difficult things. We're in a position right where we're trying to get the federal agency to take a big action, a proactive action to remove four dams, and it takes time, and it's taken time on every other river where we've seen dams come out. So I actually still am, I am today most hopeful I've maybe ever been that we're going to get those four dams out. And the reason is, there's a lot of reasons for it. You know, in addition to the huge impact that they're having on salmon, the huge connection now and recognition of their impact on orcas has completely changed the politics on this issue. Governor Inslee can no longer ignore the Snake River Dam issue because he's hearing from so many people in Washington State, so many of his constituents. The other piece that is really changing the debate over here where I live in Eastern Washington is that the benefits that we've historically, you know, received from those dams are, have been in steep, steep decline. They've never been flood control dams. They were built primarily to make Lewiston, Idaho a seaport so that barges could navigate down the Snake River to the Columbia and then to the ports on the West Coast to ship wheat, timber, other goods. What we've seen over the last 20 years is, for a variety of reasons, that farmers and shippers have been going back to rail and going back to other means of getting their goods to market, and the barging on the Snake River has declined 70%. So the argument for keeping them, that there's some sort of linchpin to our economy over here, is just getting harder and harder to say with a straight face. In terms of energy, you know, that was sort of their secondary purpose. We've also seen the relevancy of those dams on that level decline as well. You know, today we have, with the rise in renewables like solar, wind, better energy efficiency, et cetera, that energy is not worth what it was, and we have even more opportunities to replace it. And so that whole argument for keeping the dams has really declined. You know, you can even do just very conservative studies on looking at what replacing that energy would cost, like using the utility's own numbers, and it comes up at the worst case scenario, $1 a month on a utility bill. You know, we can afford to do this. So I think that people over here are starting to realize, oh, wow, these dams aren't really giving us the benefits, and they're sure costing us a lot when it comes to terms, you know, it comes with to our tribes, to our salmon, to our recreation businesses, et cetera. And the other thing I'm really excited about also, the work I'm doing over here, is looking at the value and benefits for removing those dams beyond just the salmon, right? If we took those dams out, we would have this 140-mile corridor of river habitat through southeast Washington. And as you know, Derek, it's a pretty industrialized agricultural landscape. You know, there's limited habitat in places. Here we could have this like river corridor with 14,000 acres of land no longer underwater down here in southeast Washington, and so it would benefit not just salmon, not just steelhead, but all kinds of birds and wildlife and native plants that we could have back into that corridor. And it would connect, you know, the foothills in the Northern Rockies up near Lewiston all the way down to Tri-Cities, not far from the Cascades. And I think the more we can do to create those kinds of big connections between mountain systems, before ecosystems, as we face climate change, the better off we're going to be, not just for salmon, but for all these other critters and for people too.
And let's spend like 1 minute talking about how fast rivers recover when dams are removed, whether it's Elwha or whether it's dams in Maine. That my understanding is that it was a matter of weeks when on the east it'd be shad or seagoing bass or some other creature. It takes even on human terms, it takes almost no time at all for the fish to start coming back.
Absolutely. In every dam removal, major river restoration that's happened, the fish have come back far more quickly than the scientists even predicted, within weeks, they've also been just impressed at how the river really repairs itself in terms of its riparian area. And so I think we would see benefits on the snake in terms of salmon within a couple of years. You know, we probably have a few more challenges in terms of rehab and rehabbing the banks just because of noxious weeds and things like that, but it's entirely doable. I think it would happen far more quickly than anyone allows himself to believe.
So if somebody wants to get involved, tell us a little bit more about, we've got like 2 minutes left, tell us about your organization and how people can help save our wild salmon or help the salmon in general.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to get involved depending on where you live. You can certainly go, easy things, go to our website, sign up for our alert so you know what's happening.
And your website is?
Oh, sorry, wildsalmon.org. And people can reach out to me directly, sam@wildsalmon.org, if they want some more pointers. But you can sign up and you can, you know, see the alerts and see how you can engage. If you live in the Northwest, like Oregon, Washington, we really need calls into the governors and the senators and electeds urging them to support dam removal and take action.
State senators or national senators?
National senators.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. And also right now, Washington State, if you're in Washington State, contact your local legislators also in the Washington legislature. There's a bunch of proposals moving forward right now coming from the governor's office to study and bring people together to look at dam removal and also other measures to help the orca that are relating to salmon recovery. So there's a lot happening on that front. If you have a local, you know, Sierra Club chapter, there's a bunch of other organizations, and you can look at a list on our website also of all our coalition members. You know, if you have a local group to get involved with, that's great. Lots of different people are working on it. Also, I really encourage people to spread the word and help educate friends and neighbors. If there's a local organization or you want to bring a presentation to your community, reach out to us. We'll find someone to come down and do that or give you guys the slideshow and the prep notes so that you can do your own presentations. There's also an incredible film coming out in a couple months called Dam to Extinction, which is all about the orcas and the connection to the Snake River. And you can get more information on that at damtoextinction.com. And so keep an eye out for screenings of that film, either in your community or when it starts, you know, when it's released in a couple months, you can bring, you can schedule your own screening in your own town.
Well, thank you so much for all of this. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Sam Mace. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.